Outrider Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Laboratory here on the Outrider Podcast. I'm going to keep the intro here tonight short because we've got quite a long episode. Lots of fun, lots of things that we talked about. And we do have a little guest on the show today with us besides Steven, a guy named Eric Jenkins. He's one of our co-collaborators with a website we ran for a while called Unoya Solstice. He's a young writer still trying to get published, also starting a young family, great guy. He'll chime in from time to time. Yeah, looks like we're accidentally taking a bit of a hiatus for the summer, just doing the laboratory, as I try to power through some books for some writers that I'm going to interview probably in late August or September. They have books coming out in the fall. And organizing and trying to negotiate an interview with Steve Heller, who was one of my professors at K-State way back in the day. So while we're working on all of that, we're just going to take it easy for the summer, it seems, and do the laboratory, do the exercises once a month. And it would be fun if whoever's listening would join in or at least do some comments, maybe. That would be great. I have no idea who's out there. Tell me who's out there. Come on. Let's get to it. So it's a long day. Yay.
You want to sit in your lap?
Eric was going
to sit in your lap. Yeah. I'll tell you what to say.
So how have you been, Eric?
Good. Just busy.
Been
traveling and babying.
Right. Yeah. That'll keep you busy. Mm-hmm. So did you, did Steven give you the notes? Are you just sitting in and pretending, or are you going to...
I was just going to sit in and pretend. I was reading... I read what the assignment was, but I hadn't read your pieces yet.
Oh, cool. Now, we were going to... We might as well... Had you done anything like this before? Or have you done anything like this before, Eric?
No.
Not this exercise?
Mm-mm.
Oh, cool.
Not at all.
You know what this reminded me of, or at least I might have mentioned this last time. It reminded me of, in graduate school when they would send us out with tape recorders to record conversations. Mm-hmm. And I thought about doing that, for this exercise, of sitting someplace and eavesdropping and using that as a launching point. But that wasn't kind of where I ended up, starting. How did it work for you?
I don't know why this. I don't even know why I was attracted to this exercise, because that's what I talked about before. And I guess because it's just one that I read and just I never attempted to do. And I used to do the thing where I would record people's conversations and things like that anyway. But I guess where the inspiration came from for the pieces that I did was I part of with this being the laboratory and us, us calling it that is trying to do something outside of my norm, hopefully.
Right.
Like I wanted to, push what I do. And, present that with all its, problems and, warts and whatever. In reading the prompt, immediately came to mind two extremes of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was doing something with full, just all dialogue. And then doing something with no dialogue.
Right.
And when I wrote the first one, I was thinking about there's a little bit of grad school there, and then there's a lot of when actually when Eric and I were doing the literary magazine at a school we worked at. Uh-huh. And so he'll probably recognize. I mean, I didn't take anyone's actual example, and I don't mean it, you know, as I was writing it, it was like, this is just more me kind of exercising some of that. Uh-huh. It's not really meant to be a cruel thing about like young writers, because as someone has said, smarter than I am, we're all, it's, what is it? What's that quote? Like, it's a craft that we're all apprentices in, something like that.
Right.
But these are just like, it was just a way of kind of exercising some of those just things I've hated about working with young writers.
Mm-hmm. there can be a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And or people who are kind of romanticize it or think about it in terms of, you know, their references for things are either like strictly something like Stephen King, J.K. Rowling.
Right.
The Aragon books. I'm not sure who wrote those. The kids were really into those when Eric and I were teaching.
Christopher Paolini.
Yeah, yeah. Because
I used to have to sell a lot of those books.
He was like 18 whenever that yep. first came out or was sold or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they were obsessed with yep. that. But they, you know, they're obsessed in that they want to write that. You know what yeah. I mean? Like it's like they don't get that. I mean, I don't know anything about those books, honestly. I don't know if they're good or bad. I don't, you know, I'm leery of them, but that sounds like a good marketing thing, but maybe they're good. I don't know. Have yeah. you read them or do you know anything about them?
No, no. I mean, I like I said, I used to sell them a lot when I was working in the bookstore, yeah. Which is why I remember that guy's name. You know, and there was a spate of, you know, teenagers getting published there for a while.
Was there?
About a 5 or 8 year period.
I remember him because the students talked about him a lot and they always referenced it and they were all like worried about not getting published like him, and it was hard trying to. I mean, it wasn't hard. It was just like it's just like trying to get them to listen to like when you're explaining like that's right. a one in a million, one in a trillion, one in a, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, shot as far as how that goes, you know, I mean.
Yeah. Especially since he didn't, as far as I know, he didn't have any family, you know, or.
So, yeah, I don't think there's
locational
any
connections or something like that. It's not like. There was a guy several years ago, what was his name? I don't remember. He wrote a book called, I think it was, 12. Let me see.
Yeah, I don't know that one.
I'll see the. No, that's not it. I can't remember the. oh, there it is. Yeah, 12, by a guy named Nick McDonald, right? And it was, I think it got bought. He sold it when he was 17
wow.
or something like that, 17 or 18. Yeah, he's 31 now, so this was quite a while back, 2002,
okay.
at age 17.
Has he done anything since?
Yeah, he's done a few things since. The Third Brother, An Expensive Education, The End of... You know, Major Combat Operations came out in 2010.
I'm not familiar with any of that.
Right. Yeah. But he made a big splash, you know, with that book 12 early on. And when you actually take a look at the biography, you find out that like his dad was an editor for Sports Illustrated, his mom was a novelist, and Hunter Thompson was a family friend.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Wow, yeah.
You know, so like they were going to – that book was going to land somewhere just because, you know, he could
– Sure, someone – well, someone's going to – it's not even going to hit a slush pile, you know. It's,
right.
It's going to
– And just ridiculous.
Yeah, I haven't – I don't know that. My kids wouldn't have – I don't think our students knew that. I mean, their thing was dragons or whatnot, and – you know, it was a lot of fantasy literature. So I added that, and then I added in, you know, just some of the things I've dealt with sci-fi folks. I mean, I love sci-fi, but also sci-fi readers are an obnoxious sort sometimes to me. But because I liked horror, so immediately I was an idiot. So
yeah.
So there's that in that. But then what I realized on Sunday, as I looked over it, I was disappointed in that I've written many pieces that are just dialogue. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I really hadn't pushed anything.
Right.
And so I sat down and I wrote a sentence, and then I mowed the lawn, and then I came back and did a monthly revision yesterday. I wrote what ended up to be a prose poem, which I like. I'm pretty happy with it, how it came out. But the whole thing with it was like this was supposed to be a piece that was different from what I normally do, and it comes from the prompt, but it's not a group of people, it's one person and then their memories. And then I realized, you know, I've got basically a whole chat book of it became a prose poem, and I've written a lot of prose poems. Only, you know, it's like
that should be the title of the chat book. It became a prose poem.
Done in the past. The only difference was that I did write it in second person, and I'm not a fan of that, and there's been very few things that I've read that have been successful.
Right.
And I felt okay with it, writing it in second person. It seemed okay. So that was – I mean, those were the, like, immediate kind of inspirations for the work, the pieces that I did anyway.
Yeah. So which one are you going to – is going to be the official one?
They're very different.
Which one do you want to share and have put on the website?
I guess the prose poem-y one is probably better.
Okay. Well, do you want to read that for us?
The other one was silly. What?
I like what you were saying about the dialogue. I liked how silly it was. It is like talking to one of those writers. It's my two cents, just to contradict the flow and where you're going.
All right. Well, I'll read that one then. That one was called Right Club.
So is that going to be the official one?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And this thing.
I'm just trying to nail it down so that whether you, I put the one that you read on the website.
Yeah. We'll go with this one.
Okay. Right Club.
You want me to read it?
Yeah. If you're up for it.
All right. Now, I purposely, you know, I don't know how successful some of it is. I wanted to avoid, like, I wanted it strictly dialogue with no image of the table, no image of anything else going with it. And there are multiple people, but there's no markings indicating any of that.
Right.
I hope that it's written in a way that's followable, but I don't know. So here it is. Right Club. Who else is ready? I am. Well, go ahead. Read the first line. All right. Well, remember last my idea? Yeah, this is the wizard thing, right? With the glowing mermaids? No, this is the necromancer story, part of my Orphan Hammer series, or trilogy. Double trilogy. I haven't really decided yet. Does this have the stripper lesbian vampires? No, but I suppose I could do a crossover, of course. Anyway, so this necromancer, he's like a medium. He channels ghosts? Well, yeah, technically that's what a necromancer does, but I mean, he's like a medium evil. What does that mean? Yeah, I don't get that. Okay, so say there's like good and evil necromancers, and they're like black and white wizards. A black wizard, cool. No, I mean symbolically. So more like red, like an in-between. Why red? The light spectrum is yellow-green in the middle. It's just symbolic. Oh. And I read it in another book. Anyway, it's just an example. I'm sure he'll wear different colors. I just mean that he's not totally good or evil. Morally and ethically challenged. Sure, something like that. Okay, sounds great. Go ahead. Read from the beginning. Okay, we're in the world of Kal-Da, and there's a powerful necromancer. Necromancers are known as Kal-Deed in their tongue. He has a daughter or a son. I haven't quite figured that out yet. But anyway, the kid has spells from a Kal-Kree, that's a demon, written on his skin. The Kal-Deed has to figure out a way to read them and destroy the demon without killing his kid. Well, can you read some of the spells? Yeah, that sounds cool. No, I mean what you wrote, the story. Sure, here goes. There is a darkness that lies within and a darkness that lies without. Good, go on. Well, that's it so far. Kal-Deed will be named Cronum, or his son will. What if it's a girl? Krona? I like that. Right. You should try to develop a bit more. Yeah, make it a girl. Her name's cooler. Anyone else? Speaking of the light spectrum, I wrote about life on a planet with non-green photosynthesizers. Oh, God. Cheryl, hold the comments for now. Can you explain? Sure. Don't get mad because my work takes a brain to understand, not like, say, trash fiction or whatever. That's enough. You two just have different aesthetic tastes. That's okay. It would be boring if we all liked the same thing, like werewolf love stories. He's not a werewolf. Dylan is a Wendigo. Whatever. Okay. Be critical, but we've got to be helpful. We've got different tastes. Remember, that's good. Tell us about your planets, Blade Runner. Cheryl, all right, but he started it. Like I said, there's this extrasolar world. It has non-green photosynthesizers. Because of the spectral photon flux from a different parent star, the plants and trees receive alternate bands of photosynthetically relevant radiation. The light wavelengths absorbed by the vegetation causes these plants to grow red and yellow rather than green. But that sounds interesting. Read what you have. Imagine an extrasolar world with non-green photosynthesizers. The spectral photon flux from star X111 unleashes an alternate band of photosynthetically relevant radiation on 100,000 quohars vegetation. The light wavelengths absorbed has caused the planet to grow red and yellow. Now imagine you don't have to imagine 100,000 quohar because it exists and this is its story. Wow, okay. Right now it sounds a little like a science paper, but I know you like to write that way sometimes. Are there going to be characters or a story? Yeah, I was just, you know, setting the scene. And then I was going to think about how life evolved differently on the planet because of different light. Kind of like the Foundation trilogy or the Martian Chronicles. It sounds big, like an alternate Darwin or something. I could have a spaceship land called the Beagle. Yeah, that sounds cool. Maybe start with that, depending on what story you want to tell. I also started something about more speculative about a nanobot virus that turns them into zombies. Let's save that for next week. Anyone else? I've got a poem about cutting. I got to report stuff like that. It's not about me. It's about a cousin. Someone my cousin knows. Okay, I didn't know you liked poetry. That was one of my specialties in college. What are you reading? I don't really read it. I just make it up. I could recommend something if you let me know what you're interested in. No, that's okay. I've never really liked reading it, you know. It's fun to write, though. Yeah. Right. Well, our time's almost up at this point, so how long is it? 24 pages. 24 pages typed? No, handwritten. I like to write and feel the ink and paper. I don't think we'll have time for all of it. We'll reconvene next week. That'll give you some time to revise. Revise? Ha! Who revises? Exactly. Maybe we'll talk about that too. yeah. We'll start with Mary's poem. Are there any Doritos left? So there, that's the... I just tried to think about all the things that had driven me crazy.
Oh, my God.
Sorry. Obviously, you've experienced those, too.
Well, it sounds... Where was it? It's just, yeah, the one sentence beginning. Yeah, that's all I got.
Now we would. That was one of the most common things we would have is someone would come in and they would tell us about this novel. It was never like a short story or a poem.
Right.
It was a novel or a trilogy that they were writing, and they would go on and on about the story. And then you would ask them to like, okay, well, what have you written of it? Can you read what you've written? And they would have nothing, or at most, you know, a sentence. And we're just like, it's writing, you know, like, I mean, the writing part's the hard part.
The hard
like
part,
you can
yeah.
have all these ideas, but if it's not there that anyone can read, like, what are you doing? I mean, it was just, wouldn't you say it was really common? Like, that was one of the most common things that just, it drove me crazy.
And great ideas, but when it comes down to like the work,
yeah, people just wouldn't do the work, you know?
Yeah. Hey guys, real quick, let's try and reset the connection here on Skype because you're breaking up a bit. So I will call you right back in just a second.
All right.
Just give it a couple of minutes.
She just pooped in the potty twice and peed.
And
like,
and we're back.
Hi.
Hi. Oh my god, that was a naked baby, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She just pooped the potty twice.
Yay.
Every time.
Alright. I think we've got a better connection now.
Okay, good. Yeah, is it me or is it just,
I don't know. It's just I've had that happen with Skype a couple of times where the connection just doesn't quite seem to wanna hang on very much. It was struggling there for a while. There was a little bit of static at the beginning on my end, and then you guys started breaking up and getting digital.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So just thought I'd reset it.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much, I mean, there are certain things to learn from, you know, that like you have to actually write down your ideas. revision has to happen.
Yeah.
There has to be some kind of, you know, synthesis of your own stuff and other people's stuff, you know, like rather than simply, you know, re-expressing something that's out there, you know.
Right.
I mean, you have to start somewhere, you know, and that's the thing, you know, is always dealing with young writers, you know, they are going, you know, I mean, and all of us do. I mean, you know, we all have inspiration and, and people that we kind of copy and stuff. And,
yeah, well, you know, the best writers all steal.
Yeah, we were just serious about trying to get them away from
plagiarism.
Yeah, and also just like, you know, that's great that you like Twilight, but if you just want to do this for fun, that's fine. Write whatever you want to, but by the time you finish your novel that's inspired by it, like that whole thing is going to be gone, you know.
Right.
It's I mean, if you're thinking about it in terms of a writer and like just getting stuff out there, I don't know. That so I just put a lot of my irks, the things that
I liked it. It was good.
You had more, you know, characters and setting and
well, yeah, I think
the key things in yours for me was that you had that one character, the husband who didn't speak.
Right.
So then it allowed
and you doesn't have a name.
Right. And it allowed you to like move, like because of that, it made sense to describe certain things around them. I thought that was a clever way of
well,
I guess not making it a dialogue piece the way I did.
Yeah. Well, I was kind of, you know, a lot of times when I start things like this, I don't really have a conscious idea about what I'm doing. I'm usually feeling something out And one of the things, I guess, that I've been subconsciously wrestling with a lot lately is kind of a this idea, I guess the best way to describe it is a shared focalization. I mean, a lot of times when you're sitting in those early writing workshops, you have a lot of people that struggle with controlling point of view and focalization, who is the narrative going through. And I know that there are some writers out there.
That's a Genet term.
Yeah.
Just started reading that.
And I know there's...
I've only read like the intro though, so...
Yeah.
We're kind of describes those terms, but it's like a 15, 20 page intro, so...
Oh yeah, I when I first read that, I had to take notes. It's going, this term, and this means this.
No, that's what I'm going to...
And this means this. And keep it in line so that as he goes through, I can go back and go, okay, that's what that meant. But, you know, I think some of the problems that I'm having with some of the news stories that I'm working on is that there are situations where I want the story focused just through one consciousness, but then there are situations in that same story where I want to have multiple consciousness, you know, in play so that you get that sense of that underlying unspoken tension without having to by adding to it. You know, you can create that sense of the unspoken and the unsaid with a tightly focused scene. But to do that, you have to have developed each character in such a way that you know that the one who's not focalizing it is hiding something or is keeping something secret or not saying something. And I kind of want a way to short-circuit that. And so that – and to get control of this multiple focalization of having several consciousness – levels of consciousness and – focalized points, you know, it play at the same time. So I didn't want to try and filter this through one person, but I also wanted to hold something back at the same time, mm-hmm. which, you know, may or may not be a good idea.
Yeah. No, it's hard to decide sometimes with that, but, yeah, what you want to say and what you think is there that you don't have to, that you shouldn't right. have to say, or, you know, some stuff like that. Yeah.
How do you withhold something from the reader without tricking them and manipulating them mm-hmm. and making them feel used or cheated? Right?
Because yeah.
I hate that when you read a story and, you know, you find out towards the end that the author's been withholding something. I want to think of it as the Ender's Game type of ending where you get through this whole book, there's all this tension, and then, oh, you know, you thought it was all just a game, but it's not. It was real. It's like...
That has always... I still like them, but that's always kind of bugged me about the Agatha Christie novels,
mm-hmm.
is a lot of times the solving of the crime in the Agatha Christie novels will revolve around this like bit of information that's just been withheld.
Yeah. I know there's a specific term for it. The only thing that pops into the head is the Deus Ex Machina, which is not what I'm looking for.
There's the MacGuffin, but that's right. really just a false, right? No.
The MacGuffin's the red herring. It's the thing that distracts you from what's really going on. But no, there's a way. I'll think of the term. That's the problem. You know, you spend too much time thinking about literary terms. You just have to stuff one thing in, and something has to go out the other side. Eric, any ideas?
No.
So yeah, I mean, I just wanted to try and, you know, play with that, but also get away from. You know, my day job is editing technical documents, and sometimes sitting down to write creatively, I feel like my at times out of habit and rote or whatever. There are times when the way I am structuring sentences now are becoming the way that I edit other people's sentences for technical documents.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right? And that was the kind of writing I was doing before graduate school. You know, so there's a lot of anxiety about, you know, falling into old habits. So that was the other thing. I wanted to see, you know, how I could, if it was possible to write really long sentences.
Yeah, there's, what is it, that second paragraph or like up towards the top, maybe second sentence, second paragraph or something. Mm-hmm. I remember there was a long, there was a long sentence there, and I'd kind of done the opposite with what I was doing.
Right.
A lot of it was kind of very, very short and choppy.
I suppose I should read it for people, huh?
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Let's – I don't have a title for it.
Should always name your babies.
Yes, you probably should.
I took two poetry classes, and that was what I remember from the first one. You should always name your babies.
Okay, we'll just call this then the husband.
The husband.
Okay. Her fork hovers over the salad like a wand as Lisa chats with her best friend Sarah while Lisa's husband leans away from them, having learned the value of his uselessness in all things except status symbol. Across the no man's land table, beer bottles and wine glasses and rocks glasses and empty smeared plates like shell craters and abandoned burned-out tanks, Seth and Ada hold their cell phones like shields. The job's okay, Ada says, texting a link to Seth for a website where the word douche is defined as George W. Bush. That's cool, Seth says, and only Ada knows he's talking about the definition of douche. We're putting in new counters next week, Lisa says to her best friend, and her husband tries to calculate how much time he'll have to spend at work to make the money for those countertops and how much of his soul will wither away in the process of making his wife happy enough that she'll stop acting like sex is a chore to be rushed through like the dishes. How sad, Ada texts to Seth, that Lisa has to bring Sarah along just to have someone to talk to. And Seth texts back, how sad that he doesn't have anyone to talk to. I know, right? Ada says and texts him the irony. But Seth isn't sure she's using the word correctly. He looks it up and thinks, maybe, but he steals a look at Lisa's husband, his chin in his hand, elbow on the table, his eyes focused somewhere else in the busy restaurant. He seems intent, focused. No, he thinks, this is something else. And so he texts Ada that Sarah's a good friend, and they don't see each other a lot. Sarah needs a man, Ada texts back. You need a man, Ada says to Seth. No, you need a man, Seth says. What are you two talking about? Sarah asks. Who all needs a man? Seth says. Nobody needs a man, Lisa says. Lisa's husband grunts, and no one notices except Sarah. She touches the short curl of dark hair that always tickles her ear when she has her hair cut short like a man's because she can't stand the frizz that plagues her when it's long. Remembers a summer 7 years ago. Once upon a time, Sarah says, and the others wait for her to go on, but she refuses, waiting for Lisa's husband to turn and look her way. But his eyes are on the dark-haired waitress who reminds him of someone he knew a long time ago.
Yeah, nice.
I realize I'm very, very sad these days.
I'm very, very sad these days.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess that works. I mean, the you know, the Evolution of Shadows, I put everybody through hell, and maybe that's just what I need to do with the book, is just make everybody suffer.
Well, it definitely works in that book. No, I thought you had kind of more successfully dealt with what the prompt was kind of asking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you kind of
Better than last month.
I think you captured the essence of what the prompt was asking you to do and kind of went beyond that and added, you know, a kind of a poetry to what the prompt wanted you to do.
Mm-hmm.
What I got from it was more what I realized the value for me was it made me think about various ways of approaching that prompt and also approaching that table of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the value for me. And maybe some of that's the difference in, you know, you going to school for this stuff and me not, you know what I mean? Like for me, like it was
right.
I'm getting a lot of, like, it's kind of taking the place of like, oh, okay. You know, I can do something with no dialogue, all dialogue, a mixture. But then, you know, it had me thinking about Stephen Crane in An Open Boat. Have mm-hmm. you ever
yeah.
read that? And just what he does with perspective and that. It's one of the kind of classic texts on perspective. And so it was leading me to thinking about those things and how to present them. I don't know how well I did any of that in anything I wrote, but it's making me... The process of this is making me more conscious of those things.
Hmm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
I know you're working on several manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Has any of the stuff that we've been doing or talking about over the last few episodes, or has any of it gone back into your work or helped or anything? Or?
Well, yeah, I think this one will more than the other ones. Just because I wasn't trying to. I was writing for the discovery again.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't writing because I had an idea that I was shooting for, which, you know, when you get past us, when you've been sitting with an unfinished manuscript for as long as I've been sitting with the particular unfinished manuscript I'm trying to finish, the Far 19, the Tulsa race riot story. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been a lot of
How far are you into that? Because you have Palace of Winds is done, right?
And yeah, it's
you're kind of shipping that out here and there.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question anymore.
Well, you were sending it out, and then you kind of pulled back from it.
Right. I was sending it out. I pulled back, and then last
some reconstruction, right?
Right, and then last week I've been thinking, well, why the hell, you know, okay. Why not just it is finished, and by telling myself that it's not finished, I'm putting myself into this weird limbo where I haven't finished anything in almost a decade, right? And I need to have finished something. I need that sense of having finished. And at one point, I did think I was.
How far are you in far?
Let's see. It should be done. Let's say that's how far I am in it. It should be finished.
Oh, wow. Okay. So this one you think has helped with that one somewhat? In what way? Or this exercise?
Well, it's like I said, I was back to writing for discovery rather than having an end place that I'm trying to write towards. I've been working on Far 19 for almost 2 years and don't have a finished draft yet, and I'm at 80,000 words, about 317 pages. What am I doing to myself? Right?
Oh, that's I didn't realize you were that far into that one.
Yeah.
Do you have a third one after that? I know you have ideas for them. Have you started?
I have what I always like to call developmental writing.
Sure.
Which is, you know, the first attempt at an opening scene to kind of feel out what character is wanting to talk to me
mm-hmm.
first. So, you know, I think on the book that's supposed to follow The Palace of Winds, I've got about 20 or 30 pages of farting around. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to get onto that one. And then I've got another book that I've got maybe 5 or 10 pages that I've cranked out just to kind of see, you know, if any of the characters or any of the ideas that I have about it have legs to them. But it's the thing that always pulls those up short is that I have this unfinished manuscript that I've been working on for almost 2 years that. And so a lot of the times what the writing that's going on for that isn't this process of discovery. It's like going, here's a gap I have to fill in. So let's fill this in. And it's become mechanical.
Oh, okay.
If that makes sense. And yep. So there's a certain kind of mechanical rote thing that I want to do where it's like, okay, get to the end, get the arc that you have in mind. However, you have to rig it and hammer it and
you get a draft
and kludge it into place. Do it. Just do it. Just make it finished so that you can say that since your first book was published, you finished 2 manuscripts. You know,
you said, what was it, 319 or 390? How many pages?
317. Yeah.
317.
80,600 words.
How much longer do you see that novel being, roughly?
Well, I thought I was going to bring it in at maybe 85.
385?
No, just 85,000 words, maybe 90.
Oh, okay.
Why the hell I'm writing such big fucking things right now? I have no idea. So yeah, but you know, this reminded me that this exercise reminded me that, you know, I don't have to, I can still, you know, write towards that end goal that I have in mind, but I don't have to write like a technical writer to do it.
It's a pretty open exercise. It's a pretty freeing kind of, it doesn't give you what I liked about it, it didn't give me a strict place to start, but it was a place to start, and then you just, you know, go on from there. I felt like it was useful.
Mm-hmm.
And it did make me think about perspective in a way that the previous exercise where it was like write a draft and then switch the perspective.
Right.
Which I just was lazy, just refused to do. But in this one, I wrote actually 2 pieces and switched perspective totally in from one to the other.
Right.
You know, so that's an interesting thing about, I don't know, maybe it says more about my reaction to prompts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it probably also says something about, you know, the style of complexity that goes into an exercise.
Can you explain that a little more?
Well, like our first exercise, you know, you had to take multiple texts and blend them all together. And it was dealing with large chunks of information. So it looked complex on the surface, but when you get right down technical to it, it was really simple.
It was, yeah, it was.
Right. Whereas the exercise that we both, that I struggled with and you came up with a whole different, with a whole story that you're now pursuing, that was, it looked simple on the outside because you're just creating one document, but there's lots of these little tiny moves inside of it.
Changing the perspective is like from one character to the next. That's huge.
Right.
Like that's not just like changing pronouns.
Right.
You know, it kind of makes you rethink it. And I think that's valuable about that exercise, but it also was so much that I didn't do it at all.
Like, yeah, you kind of almost need to be, it also, it kind of almost needs to be staged through over time.
Yeah.
You know, you, where it's kind of sprung on you in those stages. So you walk in on day one of the workshop and you say, write a story about an event in your life. And everybody goes out and writes a story about an event in their life from the first person. Then they bring it back in and everybody looks at it and goes, all right, now.
Now you
switch the pronouns. Oh, okay. Yada, 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 yada. All right. And they switch the pronouns, bring it up, and they're like, now, you know.
Yeah, that's actually that's a cool way of thinking about it. Yeah.
And we were trying to do that all in one big.
Yeah, one go. It definitely made me lazy about following through the whole prompt.
Yeah, it was, you know, you were expecting to run a 50-yard dash and someone gave you a steeplechase.
It's like, that's hard.
That's hard. And I'm lazy and I'm old. You
know, avoid that.
Yeah.
This one also starts with an image, and that's where I, like I've said before, that's kind of where I start from anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was.
Yeah, people around a table. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of, that was. That felt natural to me to like kind of fall into, which is maybe why I fell into two things that I've done before. One on accident, one somewhat on purpose, but trying to do something a little different than I've done in the past. But, you know, I did fall right into, you know, a structure that I like and do work. So.
Yeah. Well, it's, not going to hurt anything, you know. No. It's probably a, you know, because I certainly wasn't trying to do anything dramatically different than anything I've done before. I was just trying. I guess it goes back to that complexity thing. I was just trying to do something small in a small space as a. You know, an experiment within an exercise.
Yeah, you have a full scene. You have a lot there that in a small space. The table and the restaurant, I think, are pretty, and everyone at the table are pretty, I think, are captured by it.
Yeah,
you can see what's that full space.
Well, you got that with the Writers Club. That's just from voice, so that's significant.
Well.
I like think I went to school with some of those people when I was
young. I did. There's one in particular, one that I mentioned pretty almost. Yeah, I won't talk about it, but yeah, there's one in there from grad school that's straight from there. he always made poetry readings awkward.
Yeah. No, when I was an undergrad, there was I took a workshop on I think writing novels with Steve Heller, who I finally talked to and I'm going to be interviewing, I hope, later in July.
Cool.
But there was this guy, he was an older guy, and he was writing this science fiction book. And I think what he did was he just found a couple of interesting words in the dictionary, and that's what he decided to use for the title.
Do you remember
yes,
the title?
Yes, it was called the Poe Taster Pogrom. The Would-Be Poet Purge. And I just... So...
Well,
whatever.
That might be, that sounds... That's kind of a... You know, not too far from a Fahrenheit, a 1984 kind of.
Right, right. Thing. And
you know, what is it? Speak the 1984, getting you know, removing. Yeah, well, that and the English language. What do they call it at that point? Where they're stripping out all the words.
New speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like, and that goes back to maybe unintentionally, maybe intentionally. Who knows? That goes back to Plato, right?
Yeah.
Gotta if you, you know,
Plato the, or Play-Do.
Well, pronunciation is a.
No, I bring that up just because I.
My T's sound like D's whenever I pronounce it. And then I have some friends who are really arguing with me about it being Platon.
Platon. Right.
I got, anyway, that's a totally different story. But yeah, Plato.
But no, because I got so frustrated with the guy's story. Right.
In the ideal republic, you got to get rid of the poet.
Because he was, yeah, they were, it was called the Potester Pogrom. And, you know, this central character was, you know, I guess supposed to be the would-be poet. And the whole thing opens up with him, you know, it's this kind of pokes. I remember this book so well. I remember this story so well, and I don't know why it is. And it starts off with this guy, the central character. In this post-apocalyptic world, digging at the roadbed for this, you know, high-tech, you know, like solar. It was very, you know, as I've seen, you know, articles come out about solar power roadways, I've been thinking, this guy saw the future, man. Even though it was a bad story with bad title and whatever, you know, apparently this roadbed was valuable, so this guy who was supposed to be the potester, the would-be poet, was digging at it, and that's how the thing starts, and he's master of this pile of junk. But it was just really this kind of arcane, stilted way that he was telling the story, and I got so frustrated. You know, it's like, what does this title even mean? He doesn't do anything even remotely poetic. You know? And because that was all I had. I didn't know how to – I was just young enough and stupid enough and angry enough that I didn't know how to say anything useful to this guy. So I just had to get a dig in. So, yeah, I know that, you know, writer's table thing, writer's club really well.
Yeah, the one that I can mention from grad school was we used to host readings at a bar and – I just remember that this one guy would show up, and every time he'd go on, I mean, you know, he was one of those people that would read for 10 to 20 minutes.
Wow.
But it would be these like, and now I'm trying, you know, actually I don't remember. It was either a vampire that went to stripper shows all the time, or it was a vampire. And he would read these poems, and they would be pages and pages and pages long about strippers and vampires. And oh man, it would just kill the, you know, you would build all this momentum in the reading, and then, you know, boom,
vampire stripper guy would get up.
Here's, you know, 30 pages of this. It was just so weird. It was so weird. It was just, it was very strange, you know,
I know that feeling. Yeah. Did you ever talk to him in person? I mean, outside of the,
I was actually in the literature department, so I only knew a lot of the folks through the readings, and I was just always just uncomfortable enough not to engage. Although I did stuff like I was doing a lot of performance art stuff where I did a whole taped performance that was on cassettes where I said I was getting, like, it was me saying I was going to read this Amiri Baraka poem, and then I had a recording of Amiri Baraka reading it. And so I set up the chair and the tape deck, and a couple of the poems even had music that was backwards on them and stuff. And then I just laid in the floor of the club. the light and the mic were on this chair with a cassette. I read a series of Dylan Thomas poems with helium balloons.
Really?
In his style, but with helium balloons. If you've ever listened to Dylan Thomas's oral style, it's pretty intense.
Yeah.
I read Unskinny Bop by Poison, in the form of a 60s black activist poet. I had plenty of people that thought that stuff was bad enough and didn't like it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, if you're gonna shock the masses, shock the masses, man.
Yeah, it was the oldest bar in Alabama. It was an old biker bar, and you can see where they had actually taken a chainsaw and cut the bar one time in half to put in a pool table. famously, Sun Ra had played there at one point. So,
good grief.
It's gone now. Yeah, those were weird days. I don't think I made anyone happy doing what I was doing either. So.
At least it was, creative and aware.
It was short.
And short.
It was shorter, usually. The vampire's still at the strip club. Oh, my God.
Right, right. Oh, wow. So what are you reading besides Janae right now?
I just started the Janae because I found it. It's archived on a site.
Narrative discourse?
Yeah. And that's definitely one, like right now I'm kind of just reading through it and kind of soaking in what I can, and then I'm going to go back and, like you said, take the notes and get some of the distinctions and the vocabulary down. Mm-hmm. If I get bogged down, like say if I get to chapter 2 or 3 and I get bogged down because I'm not understanding the terms, then I'll probably just start over and go a lot slower and go ahead and write out the vocabulary. So, I started that. I'm reading.
Maybe what we could do is take an episode of the laboratory here and talk about it when we're both finished, because I'm in the process of rereading it.
Yeah, I would love to. Okay. So maybe I'll start over and kind of pay attention to that stuff anyway. I mean, I'm only like 40 pages in, but I mean, that's like the beginning of the first chapter. So.
Right.
And it's pretty short. I was surprised, it's not that long. It's like 237 something, 200 and something pages. So it's not that long. I'm still reading the Zoroastrian, documents, religious documents. I finished the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible.
Wow.
The Apocrypha. I mean, I didn't just read that this year. It was at least reading through the Hebrew and the Christian Bible. That was at least 5 years of reading here and there. So I finished those, and then I've been reading Apocrypha, and then the Apocrypha of the Apocrypha. the stuff that didn't even make it to the Apocrypha. And then,
wow.
From there, I think once I finished that, I went into the Zoroastrian stuff. The Zendavesta is the kind of collection of spiritual works from Zoroastrianism. Mm-hmm. And I plan on reading at least the Gnostic Gospel. And then, once that's kind of done, then I'll probably move to the Quran, and then I'll likely move into some Hindu and Buddhist texts. Right. So,
how fast do you go through that stuff? I mean, how do you space out the reading of it? I mean,
when I was reading, so like whenever I would read, say, Ecclesiastes or Rome, something. My goal was to read, say, 7 verses in a week,
Okay, so like one verse a day type of.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Like, it took me years, but since I started reading the Apocrypha and some of that that work, I'm actually reading a lot of that stuff at a quicker pace.
Mm-hmm.
My idea will be kind of some of it's going to be worth rereading and some of it isn't. So I'm kind of spacing that out and marking that as I go along. There's that. I just finished War and Peace.
Mm-hmm.
Eric and I are actually both reading that. Where are you in that? Have you been able to restart it this summer yet?
Yeah, I've just got about 200 pages left.
Wow.
And it's awesome.
Is that the most recent edition?
It's the...
I read an older one. I have the Great Books edition.
But the translation is it Garrett?
Constance Garrett?
Yeah.
Mine isn't. Mine's the couple who did the translation.
Oh, that's right.
Is yours Constance Garrett? Yeah. Those are both classic translations. Neither of us have one of the recent ones.
Because I've got a new one that I got when I was working at the bookstore, and I, you know, it's sitting on my shelf, you know, weighing down the bottom shelf.
Yeah, for us, it's how many years? Summers? Three years. Took us 3 years. We started reading it with a group of four.
Right.
That dwindled down to a group of two, us, and then we picked it up last summer, and we just couldn't finish it before school started. There's just so much you have to do at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were like, okay, next summer we'll close it out. And I was just, he's got, like you said, about 200 pages, which is nothing in that book.
Right.
And there's some really interesting, as far as thinking about perspective, and it's something that I'm sure Eric and I will talk about when he's done, things that happen in that book, like where it gets, like where it begins in this kind of third person.
Mm-hmm.
By the end, it's an I. It's not, I mean, Tolstoy doesn't say it's him, but I guess it's him.
Mm-hmm.
Time you get to the second epilogue, it's the second epilogue is a diatribe on history and religion and science and how these things are done. It gets weird, like Moby Dick, where you get, you abandon the narrative.
Right.
And here is some history, and here are some facts, and here's some mojo I'm going to lay down on you.
I started at 10. He just slowly.
It's because the book begins. It's a totally enveloping narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the War and Peace sections are both, when you're in the Russian court, to me, it was just as fascinating as being in the war pieces. And the war pieces, I know, I mean, I know Hemingway read, I know it's very, the writing in the war stuff is, I'm sure Hemingway took a lot from.
Right.
I don't know that. And I haven't done the reading to make that connection, but it felt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And as the book moves along, there's this narrative voice that in some ways you have to assume is a kind of either Tolstoy or stand-in form that just...
Right, an implied narrator, an implied author. Right.
To intrude, and intrudes more and more until he becomes... The second epilogue, I said that book ends with just him talking about abstractly...
Mm-hmm.
Ideas. It's the narrative is gone. In the first epilogue, it's he kind of slows down the narrative and ends it, and then begins this whole diatribe on historians in the history of the Napoleonic Wars.
Right.
And so to me, it reminded me of the whaling, you know, just all the whaling chapters in Moby Dick, where your narrative's totally abandoned and you're just learning about whaling of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
It just really moves very strange towards the end of the book, this narrative presence that becomes more and more prevalent until the end ends with that.
Right.
And the ideas in the book becomes more and more abstract as it moves towards the end. It's really interesting.
I wonder if that somehow influenced the, maybe someone has an exact answer for that, but maybe that's something that influenced the trend towards, you know, this kind of journalistic reportage philosophy of fiction, where it should be well researched and based in fact. And it's like, no.
He is, yeah, the book is meant to be, how do I say it, a bandage? There's no better word for it. A tonic to the faulty history
right.
of those wars. And more as you get towards the end, he's presenting that in more and more obvious ways, mm-hmm. as this is meant to be to liberate the true facts of the narrative of,
right.
of that war. It's
interesting.
You know, it's just one of those things. It's like, you know, when I sat down and I probably said this before, like sat down and listened to Beethoven string quartets, and you're like, wow, this is some of the greatest music ever written. It's, you know, strikes you in that kind of sense. Is like, wow, this Tolstoy guy, he's pretty good.
He really knew how to do that stuff.
Yeah, that Tolstoy guy, he's pretty good. You feel like an idiot, you know, kind of.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, that the thing that I find so often is people don't, at least whenever I was, I mean, I don't see this on a daily basis. I know it was more in college where people would just kind of celebrate things, but they really hadn't read them or listened to them or explored them. And like, we're all supposed to love Shakespeare and Mozart and this kind of stuff.
Right.
But they don't really explore it. Or you had the total opposite end where you had everyone talking about the collapse of, you know, anything canonical and all of that. So I don't know. It's an epic book, you know.
Right.
What else? I just finished a grammar book from the 1834.
But that was fun. Didn't you say you were reading Ondaatje?
I am. I'm about 77 pages into The English Patient. Beautiful. It's one of those things where you read it and you're just, it's pretty beautiful and poetic,
uh-huh.
but it's also, it's not straining in any way. Like,
right.
it's very easy to read, totally smooth in its reading. The yeah. pacing, the use of time. And that's why I was like, oh, this is why he kept telling me to read that. And probably why you got annoyed with all the comparisons to Hemingway with The Evolution of Shadows.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great so far. I mean, from the beginning.
Well, cool. When you're done with it, we can talk about that one. I mean,
yeah. What are you reading now?
Well, I'm working my way through Narrative Discourse again. I've been attempting to, I don't remember, it might have been a conversation that I had with Troy Weaver or I don't know who it was anymore, but they had said this, that, you know, a lot of people, you know, we had this excuse that, oh, we don't have enough time to read. I wish I had more time to read. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, when you're sitting on the toilet, you've got enough time to read a, you know, one great essay by somebody.
Sure.
Or, you know,
at least a poem.
Or a poem or two. And if you're, or you've got, or during dinner, you know, if you're not with anybody, you can probably squeeze in a short story while you're eating dinner, right?
You have of our lives.
Right. You have time to read. You just have to make the choice to read.
If you're at dinner and you're alone.
I'm alone at dinner all the time. So what I've been trying to do is
throwing things at me. I've got, you know, there's like bathroom breaks. There's, you know, there may be vomit. There's, you
right,
know,
right.
So yeah, my dinners are much different than cracking a book open.
Yeah. Your dinners are much different than mine. You know, But yeah, so I've been trying to get through Eudora Welty, the collected stories.
The stories, cool. Yep. I haven't, you know, she's someone I've had so many people tell me about that P.O. story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it's her. It's like a walk to the P.O. or do you see it there in the table of contents?
Why I live at the P.O.
Why I live at the P.O. I've heard so many people tell me that they love that story, and I just have not read her stuff. How is it? How far have you? How much have you read? Because you weren't reading that last time.
I've gotten up to let's see. I've read two of the short stories out of that collection so far. Because I always come up with some excuse to not sit down at the table and read, but instead, you know, turn on the TV and just. Usually it's because, you know, I've gone out for a run or a bike ride. Mm. It's like, I'm tired. I don't want to think. Just want to eat and veg. And completely defeating the purpose of trying to get through Welty. Because once I get through Welty, I have Flannery O'Connor waiting in the wings.
I've read a lot of those stories, but I plan on sitting down. I've got the collected. I used to teach Wise Blood. Novel.
Yeah. And then I have
what about the Ashbery? You still reading that?
Yeah, I think I've got a few poems left in that. I got distracted by The Unbearable Lightness of Being.
Did you finish that or?
Yep. That was I loved that one. Cool. You know, that's the thing about poetry collections is that I don't feel the urge to get to the last page is in the same way that I do with the novel because
I read it most usually two or three a day. And try to kind of, cause I've actually got a little bit of a backlog of poetry magazines that I'm reading right now. So, but the focus, you know, just to read poetry well, the focus you should bring to it, or at least I feel like I need to bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
I can only read, you know, it's at most at a sitting for the poems. And then I kind of have to, you know, set it aside and read something else.
Right. Kind of let the brain stew on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So how's the Ashbery gone so far? Had you read, you hadn't read his stuff before?
No, I hadn't. I might have heard one or two poems here and there before.
Difficult, so, but you said you were enjoying it. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm going to knock out the last few poems and I'll be done with that one. But, you know, there for a while,
that's not everyone's, it's just interesting that your fiction and predominantly, I mean, I would say you identify probably as a novelist more mm-hmm. than you would like that as much as you've seemed to, or have enjoyed it as much as you seem to, because he's often seen as kind of a, you know, kind of difficult, you know, or I mean, in not, you know, he's not very narrative. He's not,
right.
I don't know how to describe him, but.
Well, you know, in some ways he kind of reminds me of James Tate.
I think you mentioned that.
And
James Tate's great.
And James Tate, you know, the reason I kind of fell in love with him was to a certain extent his sense of humor there for a while, you know, locked into the way that I was originally introduced to poetry as a kid, which was through you know, the books that Shel Silverstein put out,
yeah,
like, you know, the End of the Sidewalk, Light in the Attic, you know, that type of stuff. In grade school,
not for me too.
The disc is too slow, so I don't know how decent our recording is going to come out.
Okay.
Anyway, so Shel Silverstein was the first one, and then, you know, when I showed a little bit of interest in poetry, my dad, liked to entertain me with Mason Williams poems. And he's...
Yeah, I don't know.
He's a satirist of a certain kind and a... let's see if we can look him up here.
I went directly to Poe after Shel Silverstein, you know, like,
yeah.
Never came back from it, so.
Well, he was a musician and composer. Mason Williams, are you familiar with Classical Gas?
Yeah, the song, right? It's a song,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
That's Mason Williams, but he also was a bit of a poet and a comedian. And
oh, okay.
So he was on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, Campbell stuff, you know, Saturday Night Live.
I've probably heard him before.
You probably have.
Yeah. Well, I know Classical Gas. So.
But he also had he also would occasionally write poetry, you know, comedic, funny, ha-ha type of stuff.
So was this in your dad's Playboys? Was he like...
No. My dad just had a collection of it. But yeah, I mean, my dad had Shel Silverstein in the Playboys. My dad wasn't the one that introduced me to Silverstein. It was, you know, my grade school teachers that had, you know, the End of the Sidewalk, right, or Light in the Attic and stuff like that, that introduced me to Shel Silverstein. And then I would go and I would sneak into my parents' room and find my dad's Playboys and be like, Shel Silverstein? What the? In Between the Naked Ladies. All right.
Win.
Win. Yeah. Exactly, Eric. Exactly. When you realize that your childhood wonder and boobs are somehow intricately connected.
Absolutely.
You know, but, yeah, I don't know why my dad was attempting to, you know, warp my brain just a little bit. So it was, you know, Mason Williams poetry, a collection of his called Flavors that had, some poems in there, like, them beaver cleavers or them sticker getters, you know, and they're just obnoxious rhymed, you know, sing-songy annoying verse, you know, and aside from Hallmark cards, that was really my only exposure to poetry. Aside from when I first got to college, hearing those boring droll, I am reading a poem to you that's important, and you should pay attention to the words that I'm saying. You know that reading voice that poetry gets?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And yet, you know, when my grade school teachers or my dad would read me Shel Silverstein or Mason Williams, there was, you know, life and vibrancy and funny and, you know, I could probably get up and go grab the Mason Williams book and read something to you. Do you want me to do that?
Sure.
All right, I'll be right back. Hold on.
Well, we can pause and I'll refresh here.
Okay.
And then we'll come back to some Mason Williams.
All right. Okay, there's the record button. Let's see. Okay. So this was some of the first poetry I was ever introduced to by my father. Them sticker getters. This is a Mason Williams poem, Flavors. How about them sticker getters? Ain't they neat? Getting them stickers in they feet. Getting them goat heads. Getting them briars. Getting them out with sticker picking pliers. Look at them sticker getters. Can't they cuss? Soon's get a sticker, raise a mighty huge fuss. Them tender-footed sticker getters, how they squeal. Stickers in they toes. Stickers in they heels. How to be a sticker getter? Don't need a ticket. Stick your foot in the weeds. Let the stickers get it. Right?
I like, though, that there was a time when that kind of interest in language like that, well, I guess it's still here, but it's slightly more serious in terms of, I guess, really like rap and hip hop and stuff. Uh-huh. There still is that
playfulness.
Yeah, playfulness and also an interest in language as it is. It's just it's moved from that, you know, I guess. That aspect of popular culture and has kind of moved into a different one, you know. It's kind of presented in a different format, different place. But
do you want to hear them beaver cleavers, just in case?
Yeah.
Okay. How about them beaver cleavers? Ain't they rank? Cleaving them beavers down on the bank. Cleaving they heads in, cleaving they spine, clomping them beavers, ever one they find. Look at them beaver cleavers. Ain't they a shock? Some use a ball peen. Some use a rock. Them ever clever beaver cleavers hiding in the leaves. Beaver comes by, gets a few cleaves. How about to be a beaver cleaver? Ain't much to it. Just cold cock or beaver. Reckon that'll do it.
Beaver.
Man. You know, I guess a lot of stuff is going to kind of seem boring after that.
Well, of course not. You're, you know, and so when someone reads a poem, you know, a standard, you know, academic poem, you know, the house was sad and then, and you're like, going, sitting in the back row going, where's the life in this? Come on. Yeah. You know,
have you, that first, you know, that stuff there reminds me a little bit of my friend Abraham Smith's poetry. Although it's not, you know, his stuff isn't that silly.
Right.
Which I love. That beaver one is just, what was it? Some do with a ball peen, some with a rock. That's great.
Hiding in the leaves, beaver comes by, gets a few cleaves.
one poem that he's asked to read all the time, and he writes, for me, he's, his style, he brings together a lot of opposites.
Mm-hmm.
So he has almost a language poetry element, which some way that Mason Williams kind of sticker getters and all that, like, is kind of playing with that. And then there's narrative, is there, his presentation of the poems is kind of like a whiskeyed up preacher, almost the way he reads. One of the poems that he's always asked to read is this one where he kind of beats up a chair and he ends up taking it out into the woods and throwing it into a tree. He's describing this chair that he's thrown into the trees. You'll have to check out some of his stuff. I think I've sent you some links. I don't know if you've, but that actually reminded me of some of his, some of his work in a way.
Yeah. Well, I've never heard James Tate read, and I would be very disappointed if he reads in that somber, you know, I am reading a poem voice.
I haven't either. I was so happy when a coworker, I think last year, brought me a book. It's like collected modern poets.
Uh-huh.
Like that. Let me see. It's right over here.
But if you happen to seen, I'm sure you've seen videos, if you haven't seen him in person, Taylor Molly perform and read his poetry.
I've seen videos. He did the teacher one, right? He's
correct.
Isn't he? Yeah. He's kind of famous for that teacher poem. And I heard about him first on your podcast.
Yeah.
And then, this book called The Modern Poets. What I was so excited about is it has a full page picture of everyone in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, I've never seen some of these people. Like, it was cool just to see, you know, that's what Theodore Rothke looks like. Wow. Okay. Although there's a lot of stuff online. There's a couple of at least one documentary of him online now.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard Taylor, and you know, but he's also doesn't he come out of, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't he come out of the slam?
Yeah, he's definitely started off more in the performance thing, but he is, he also did, you know, the creative writing thing. He is.
There's performance poetry, there's slam poetry, there's a whole mix of
and
different styles or whatever. I'm not sure what to call all of them.
Right. But, you know, his poetry reads well on the page. You know, it doesn't, it's not the kind of stuff that only works in performance. And that's what a lot of the performance poetry that I've heard, it doesn't really work on the page quite as well as it works in performance.
Right.
And then of course there's a lot of performance poetry that it doesn't matter who the poet is. They all seem to adopt that same rhythm. I am telling you a poem about this thing that's really troubling me.
No,
right?
Exactly.
And they all sound the same. But Taylor's unique in that, you know, he's, in fact, he does a reading where he pairs a poet that's normally known as a performance poet with a poet that's normally known as an academic, you know, bookish poet. He does it in the Bowery in New York, in one of the bars there.
He talked about this on the show, didn't he?
A little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a great thing because he actually is someone who does both very well.
Well, he's conscious of it and he's thinking about all of that, which is what we need to be doing as artists, if we're going to call ourselves that and all that, you know, I mean.
And if we're ever going to hope to, you know, win back an audience from television and movies and video games, is we've got to do a little bit of what, or a lot even of what Taylor does, which is, you know, and I think I talked about him in that interview and with other stuff is that, you know, when I show up and a poet doesn't put some thought into the performance, into the reading of his poem, I'm like going, motherfucker, you just, I liked your poetry until you read it to me.
Wow.
And now when I read your poem, all I'm going to hear is your boring monotone.
I felt, there were several, you know, there were several articles on Poet Voice lately that have been coming out. And I agree. At the same time, though, I also agree that, you know, there is a kind of standard for slam stuff and all that. You know, there's a slam voice. There's, like you said, you know, here's someone who's going to tell you, you know.
Right, I'm going to tell you about my troubled childhood and the things that it's like, and that's what's it. I mean, and that's the thing is that if you've only seen one or two videos of Taylor doing one or two certain poems, then you think, but each poem is performed differently. His performance matches the tone of the poem really, really well.
So sometimes I want to think though, like, you know. It's tough because I know James Joyce, you listen to readings of him, he was very conscious, you know, he had one time thought about pursuing singing. Mm-hmm. So you hear him read, it's very performance oriented, you know, Yeats.
Right.
Is very like over the top, you know, very, he's performing Dylan Thomas.
I should see if I can find some Ann Waldman videos for you. You want to see some over the top stuff. I mean,
I bet Nabokov was the same way. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know if I've ever heard him read anything, but I can imagine that there was a certain amount of performance there. But I also want to say that to a certain extent, I don't want to require someone, you know, to do something that maybe they're just not good at. You know?
Right, right. But have some life. I mean, you can, this is, have you ever been to any of the Poetry Out Loud readings at the student recitation competition?
I haven't, no.
One of the things that I found really fascinating, this, I was asked to judge a Poetry Out Loud competition here in Wichita last year, or earlier this year. And it's the National Poetry Recitation Competition for high school students.
Right.
And, you know, they don't teach, and they teach that kind of, that middle ground between the performance slam poetry thing, which is all very theatrical, and the boring academic, you know, I am reading a poem to you that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And what they teach is, you know, the performative interpretation of a poem. And it's really fascinating, the whole philosophy behind it, and then the way these kids go out there and do that. I love it. I think it's I'd heard a little bit about it, but actually getting asked to judge it and seeing these kids get up and, you know, they and read these poems, and they've been taught, you know, to interpret them a certain way, to put emphasis on certain words, to show that they understand what the poem means, to inflect and then to use that performance, their voice, to convey that meaning. That creates a very different way of reading a poem that I think a lot of poets need to actually study when they're reading their own damn poetry.
Sure, yeah.
You know? So yeah, I think there's something to be said for at least learning how to present your poem orally in such a way that people aren't bored.
Right.
That no, people don't feel like you're, you know, being lulled to sleep.
What's Kermit's nephew's name? The little frog? Do you remember?
No. I was never a Muppet person. Eric? That's
blasphemous.
Well, you looked at him. I was like going, Eric must know.
He's got a machine in his hand that connects him to information that's stored. Little ones and zeros. Yeah, it's Kermit's nephew. Anyway, I was at an academic reading, and
Robin.
So Robin the Frog. It's Kermit's nephew. It was like a little version of Kermit.
Seriously?
He didn't have the kind of really cool mane or whatever that is that Kermit has. You know, the yellow
the ruff.
You know, he didn't have that. I guess when you get like to be a big frog, you get a mane. But I went to this reading, and I'm one of those people. I saw a guy one time in a church, and he had sweatpants on, and I just laughed the entire service. I couldn't stay, and I had to leave early just because there's sweatpants really make me laugh. There's a scene in The Exorcist where Father Karras is just running around a track, and he looks over at another character, and he's running in sweatpants, and I howl with laughter every time I watch the movie and see that. Another time I saw an Asian guy turned around. He looked like an Asian Tom Selleck. And just because that got into my head, I had to leave. It's happened in a few occasions. Well, this was a poetry reading, and I almost had to get up and leave because the reader sounded like Robin.
Oh, my God.
And it's a high-pitched Kermit the Frog voice.
Right.
And she read everything that way. And I just looked at the table, and I looked at my wife, and she was like, yeah, I know. You know, if you got to go, you better go.
Yeah.
You know, if you need to leave now. The door was on the other side of the room, though. So I just – all I could think of was Robin the Frog. It's terrible.
I once sat through a wedding where the minister performing this ceremony sounded like Johnny Carson.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. I sat through another wedding where the preacher, the priest, the Catholic priest, looked like the serial killer from Sling Blade.
Nice.
And
the last wedding we went to, the choir, and the choir, they were way up high, up above everyone else. The angels singing up there. It looked like my grandfather, who's a choir guy, and then right next to him, it looked like Salman Rushdie. Oh, it's just I couldn't look up there after I attached that in my mind. You know, my grandpa's singing in the choir up there with Salman Rushdie.
Yeah, yeah.
This started with you reading John Ashbery.
Yeah, well, John Ashbery, the poets, Mason Williams, you know, that type of stuff. But no, the other thing the last thing that I'm reading right now is, I got a bunch of galleys from Unbridled and from Caitlin Hamilton, who is also has her own independent publicity agency for stuff like that. So, yeah, all of a sudden I got hammered with, I mean, I've been struggling to find guests, and then all of a sudden Caitlin and Unbridled, you know, through
are for guests. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. For possible interviews. They threw three writers at me. Virginia Pye, who has been on my list for a while. Her first novel, River of Dust, came out a couple of years ago, and I just started reading that. And they sent me a galley for her new book that's coming out in August or September. And I got sent a galley for Elise Blackwell's new book, which I don't remember the title of. And I've been meaning to read her book, The Unnatural History of Cypress Parish, for quite some time, but haven't gotten around to it.
I know that title, yeah.
Yeah. And then I also got sent a galley for a book called American Copper by Shan Ray, which is about the Montana copper mining corruption stuff in the.
Is it fiction or nonfiction?
Fiction.
Fiction. Oh, okay.
Yeah, in the early part of the 20th century, about all that.
That's stuff. A good title.
So. Yeah, I'm looking forward to reading all of those, and I'm having to. Oh,
so you got hit with a bunch of stuff there.
So I've got to start.
You got work reading to do.
Yeah, I've got work reading to do business. And pleasure reading. And oh, I also got sent. So there are four authors. I also got sent a galley for a book called Thicker Than Blood by Jan English Leary, which is another one that I need to get through for. A possible interview. So I've got stuff packed, stacked up. And what I'd really rather do is sit down and play Fallout, you know, New Vegas.
Eric knows what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's a band, right? Is that a band?
No, it's a video
game. It's a video game. Sorry.
Yeah.
Ooh, a band I almost heard of.
It's so sad and pathetic. Eric, how do you get anything done with an Xbox in the house?
I don't turn it on. I keep it unplugged. I literally keep it unplugged.
That's an idea.
So then I have to crawl behind my TV to plug it in.
I would have to move the power strip to do that, because my power strip is easily accessible.
Yeah. See, I don't. So are you guys both gamers? You both gamers?
I know of games. I mean, I couldn't call myself a gamer even, just because I don't do it often enough.
But you would be.
I would be if I had time to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a fairly young dad, so he's trying to be responsible.
So yeah.
Do you play like a lot of different games or anything? Or?
Well, no, I have. I'm
certain games that you
I'm
like.
I'm not a very, you know. I know that if I let myself do it, I would just sit and play video games all the time.
Same.
Yeah. I have no interest.
But there are only certain types of games that I like. You know, one of the first games
I played Galaga in Austin when I was there, and that was in a NASCAR pinball game. that was totally good. Like, I'm done for 5 years. Like, I don't have to play another video game.
But no, I mean, when one of the first games I bought when I first got the Xbox, one of the first games I got was Call of Duty. And because that was, you know, the big thing that everybody was like, Call of Duty, you know, and I don't like it that much. There's just some too much of a free-for-all for it. You know, there's not really a story behind it. Even though there is a story behind it. It's just not very
I don't want a story at all if I play a video game. I just want to shoot things and blow things up.
Right. You can do that with Call of Duty. You would probably like Call of Duty.
Yeah. Sounds like one I would like.
But no, but games like Fallout.
Right.
Destiny, I mean, you're like, it's, you're playing a story. You're playing. Like,
yeah, I don't want that.
Right. Because it's, it does have a narrative, and you have to interact with characters on there and ask questions, and you can make choices throughout the game that affect gameplay later on with Fallout. And, but I also like the BioShock series a lot.
I don't know. I know of it. I haven't played it.
Yeah, I don't know.
And the Dishonored video game, I like that as well. And I tried like Assassin's Creed, but didn't like it too much. It's too complex, too complicated with the controller for me.
Well, once I moved away from the Atari, like, well, okay, Nintendo, I could do a Nintendo thing controller, although I never beat Super Mario Brothers. I may be the only person my age who never beat Super Mario Brothers.
I never even played it.
Oh, really? Wow, yeah. That was everyone. Everyone's beaten that. I've never beaten it. Like, I'm crazy.
There was something about the Super Mario games that I just never liked.
They're kind of dumb.
So I never played them.
I feel like video games for me too are like, I don't want a story. It's kind of like, the way I feel about a lot of current TV and stuff, for me, even like the shows, and I acknowledge that a lot of them are well written and whatever. I watched one episode of Game of Thrones and I was like, nope, can't do it. the first time I watched some of The Walking Dead, I watched 3 episodes and I was like, can't do it.
Eventually I lost interest in those.
I didn't lose interest. With those shows, the thing is it's suspense, 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 suspense. There's no
boring parts.
It's, well,
you want to be bored?
No, I can't handle 6 seasons of the
perpetual anxiety.
It really makes me nervous.
Where's the comic relief? Where's the valley that gives you a little bit of a breather?
Yeah. Well, I can handle, you know, I can handle that in a horror movie that's 120 minutes long, or most of the time 90 minutes long, you know, an hour and a half in a horror movie or suspense or thriller, you know, I'm okay with it. I can't do that long form thing with the tension. I'm much better with episodic TV.
Well, how is it different? Steven really liked Daredevil. Have you seen Daredevil on Netflix, Jason?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, what made the difference in Daredevil? Because I would say...
Well, I would say that part of that is a couple of things. One is just that is actually one of the few comic books that I really read as a kid and really, really liked the character. The other thing is what makes that show different from all of the Marvel stuff out right now that I can think of, everything I can think of, is that it actually spends a good chunk of the season developing the villain and makes him as interesting and as human and as personable. Plus it's Vincent D'Onofrio, who's a great actor. But they spend that time with the villain to flesh out a story. It's not just tension, you know. They're telling a story, but it's not like there's an overall tension, but it's not like.
Well, here's an interesting twist to put on it, because the thing with Daredevil in particular was that the entire arc of the season was released all at once. It's not like The Walking Dead and whatever, where it's you have to wait.
I was watching it when it was
7 days in between.
It didn't matter.
A release, and then you have occasional times where they go weeks or months without a new episode just because of holiday stuff and scheduling and whatever.
I'm so far behind on TV, like, that hasn't affected me. I'm right with you. Like,
because that does affect me. I mean, the reason I stopped watching.
But you know, that week to week thing also makes it kind of exciting and more interesting in that you have a natural stopping point
Right.
And you can think about it, and it becomes an event.
Mm-hmm.
That's how Twin Peaks was for me. That was really like the last time that I really sat and did, I guess, except Tim and Eric, awesome show I would wait for. That totally has a different kind of feeling than mm-hmm. Twin Peaks. But I just can't do... I'll say, like, I watched 3 seasons of Walking Dead, and
right.
I really like season 2, which everyone seems to hammer on and say they hate. And I enjoyed it because it developed all the characters, and then you also got to experience, there was tension in that. Have you seen it?
Mm-hmm. I've seen chunks of most of season 1, most of season 2, I think. And
so, spoiler alerts if someone wants to, whatever. Anyway, I feel like it's been out long enough.
Yeah, it has been out way long enough.
I really enjoyed that second season where there was a pocket of development with the characters, and then there was like almost an apocalypse over again at the end of the season. I really enjoyed that
season. Yeah, I've seen the first 3 seasons.
That's all I watched too. But most people don't like that second season. They complain about it. I'm just not... I just haven't been a TV person. I just haven't.
No,
I did like the Daredevil series. I thought I enjoyed it, but it was also very episodic in that I didn't.
You didn't.
It wasn't the same as like someone's going to die any minute.
Oh, right.
All the time, which is in Breaking Bad. What I watched of it, you know, at any moment I felt like any member of his family was going to die, or he was going to get caught or something. Mm-hmm. Walking Dead, someone's always about to die. same thing. Game of Thrones, I got that from the first episode. I was like, I can't handle this.
Yeah, it's the Game of Thrones is the, I think the most thing that, you know, keeps people coming back is like, who's going to die this episode? Who's going to die this year?
You know? I did, you know, I have liked True Detective.
Mm-hmm.
I did enjoy that.
So, I guess kind of we're nearing our 2-hour mark here, and we kind of need to figure out what our exercise is going to be.
Yeah.
For next time. How do we something that's not too complex but not too easy? If that makes sense. Do we,
for the assignment or
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would have to probably look in my books. I don't have anything offhand.
Let's see.
I mean, do you remember one that you've done? I mean, we could even, or that you remember from grad school that you.
Well, the ones from grad school really that I remember and always like to use are the real simple ones, like the I remember exercise. And then there's my other favorite one was what we called an Ilo Molo. But you actually need a room full of people for that one.
Oh, yeah. I'm not really. Well, I have a room full of people, but not all of them speak clear English. So.
Yeah. Well, and they all need to be working on the same writing exercise at the same time. It's it's kind of a writing exercise in the round, and it can be a lot of fun because what it starts off with is you take a real simple writing exercise like the I remember exercise, which is you start off with the phrase, I remember, and you write for, you know, 5 minutes. And anytime you get stuck, you just start over again with, I remember. You know, I remember the time my uncle told me that, you know, cats, you know, yada, yada, whatever. You keep writing until the 5 minutes are up or until you reach the end of that thought. And then if you reach the end of that thought and the 5 minutes isn't up, you start over again with, I remember. So that's what you start with. That's your base in the Ilo Molo. But then about 20 to 30 seconds into that process, someone has to say a word. out loud to the class, and everybody then has to incorporate that word into their exercise.
Oh, okay.
And you write for another 20 or 30 seconds, and the next person in the circle says a word, and you have to incorporate that word into your exercise and keep going. So I remember my uncle said, you know, barracuda, and, oh, whatever. And then you got to somehow work barracuda into what you're doing. The next person says donkey, and you've got to work that into whatever it is you're – and let that twist and redirect whatever you're working on. Well, you do that maybe once or twice around the circle during that five-minute time frame, and it can create some really fun and amusing stuff to kind of throw you out of your consciousness, but we really can't pull that off.
I wouldn't be able to with my folks. Although that sounds like the conversations we have on a daily basis.
Well, you know, if we could get ourselves and a couple other writers into a room at the same time, it might be fun.
Isn't that why we're talking?
Yeah. we could give it a shot. But no, I think I'm trying to think of something since we veered off into video games and movies. What we could do that, you know, because as we were sitting there talking about that, I realized that, you know, that in a way is our competition. That's what we're having to compete.
Sure. Yeah.
When people say, I wish I had more time to read, what we're competing against with is, you know.
Well, I've had many people.
Seasons of Daredevil released all at once. And
they'll tell me, I don't have time to read, but I like to watch. I watch a lot of movies.
Yeah, I binge watch a TV show over a weekend. It's like
now, yeah, that
right.
Would be,
you could have been reading.
Like, right, this is like over 10 years ago. I remember a lot of people would tell me that, just friends, that they didn't have time to read, but they had time to, you know, I can watch a movie. It's like that doesn't. So that never made sense to me.
Right.
It's
90 minutes where you just sat and did nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know how to tie that in. What are you thinking?
Well, we're sitting here reading Janae, and Janae was one of the components that struck me in graduate school. I had this idea that, and I think we've talked about it before way back when and stuff like that, is that novel writing in particular seems to be trapped in this 19th century pedantic model. It's written as if we still experienced life, you know, from the back of a horse, or at most in the passenger car of a steam train. That's the fastest we travel, and so that's the fastest we write. So we do a lot of scene setting and development and transition, you know, the types of things that happen when you are traveling at a slow rate of speed on land. Right?
Yeah.
Whereas we're now living in a world where you can, you know, hop on an airplane, you then experience nothing of the world around you for anywhere from, you know, 1 hour to 8 hours or more. You step off the plane and you're in an entirely different side of the hemisphere, even, right? That type of quick transition. What would you do in that time there? There's a whole story there, but yes. But oftentimes, even in, well, let's take, for instance, my book, my characters, there's no transition. There's no writing about the flights they take from the middle of the U.S. to Bosnia. They just make the jump.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I've often talked about the, what I call the Iowa introduction to the novel, you know, the Iowa opening of the novel, you know. During the summers, we always used to walk to my grandmother's house, but this one day.
Right.
Right. And this kind of big scene setting and stage setting this is part of the reason I need to go back and reread Janae, where he's talking about, you know, the ellipses and the way that he structures time, is that, you know, the duration and repetition, these anachronies that he talks about, you have in that first paragraph of the Iowa opening, you know, this setting of ritual, and then you disrupt it, and that's where that creates the tension of, well, I'm thinking to myself, why do we do that? Because we don't actually do that when we watch movies. We don't do that to ourselves.
Right.
You don't, when you go to a movie, they don't spend the first 5 minutes of the movie, you know, taking long shots of the neighborhood where the character lives and, you know, describing their relationship to their mother and in prose or whatever. They just dump you right into the opening scene.
Mm-hmm.
No, any backstory you've got, you've picked up from the trailer, which is easily paired to the blurb on the cover of the book. That's the sure. similarity between them. They just throw you right in the pool and you're expected to swim. So why do we spend all this time in fiction building the backstory that we could let out as we swim in the pool, so to speak? Why haven't we sped up our model? And I think that's where a lot of readers sometimes get bogged down, is that they sit and think about, they pick up a book and like, oh, this is so boring. Why am I hearing all this about this description about this town and this car and this thing?
Our students in teaching high school they hate descriptions of setting. They really, part of it is it's hard for them to relate that to anything metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
Anything in terms of metaphor, and so they don't want to. And so as they read, they're just like, this is all description, it's nothing. Like,
right.
They're so plot based, you know, they're mm-hmm. so like, you know, events, this happens. Like, to them, that's when they understand what happens in a work, is that this happens, then that's why they're so amused with, you know, Cliff's Notes and things like mm-hmm. that. Well, I know what happens, it's cool.
Right.
I know that work, yeah, I know what happens in it. And,
right.
And
it's not that. And that's the thing, is that description is now used to just fill space. They spend all this time describing things that people already see every day.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, my text is The English Patient, and as well as the movie. You know, there's this great passage in the movie where Catherine says to Almasha, you know, I never thought you could write such a, you know, a brilliant text with so few adjectives. And he says, well, it doesn't matter whether it's a broken car or a running car or a fast car, whatever, it's still a car. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter all the shit you put around it. A car is still a car. You know, and then she responds with, well, you know, take love. They're very different things. Filial love, romantic love, those are very different things. And he goes, well, you have me there. And that, to me, that kind of defines the whole thing.
Is physical, love
the
is
car
abstract.
Is physical. If you're sitting there, you know, describing a building and stuff like that, it's like, yeah, I've seen a building before, motherfucker, come on. You know, give me some rough outline so I kind of know, is it a skyscraper? Is it a house? Is it a cottage? Is it, you know, you can give some real basic, you know, forms
it's like
of description.
Word choice. Just call it a cottage, a skyscraper.
Right. and trust, right. And trust the reader to fill in the stuff with their imagination, because, you know, with Google Maps now, if you want to know what a street looks like in Istanbul and you've never been to Istanbul, Google Map that shit. You know what it looks like. You can figure it out. Why waste time describing stuff that anybody can see? And instead, describe the strange, describe the different, describe the things that, you know, these, I'm sure even your students would be fascinated by a description of something that they had never seen before. What does that look like? Why would that be that way? You know, you describe. It's putting that twist of originality onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of why I kind of adopted So yeah, we're way over time here. We're gonna have a well. I'm gonna cut a bunch of this out because of this stuff.
Yeah, you gotta edit some stuff. Yeah, where does that lead us to?
To an exercise. Well, how do we want to experiment with that? So I'm thinking maybe, you know, we need to. Any ideas, Eric?
I heard two things. One, the describing something that's completely original that isn't going to be something as simple as, like you said, a building, a car, skyscraper. And the other thing, it sounded like you're wanting to write something that is just like cut twos, that's pure action. It really, what you were talking about reminded me of, I'm reading the Maze Runner series right now because I got a bunch of new books for my classroom and that was it. And so I just finished the second one. And that's all it is. Even when they have these creatures in there that, you know, I've never seen these creatures before that are in there. Even the description is like, well, they got knives for hands and there's these yellow and there's these like glowing bubbles sticking out of them. And it doesn't, like, there's not a description of those creatures besides that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the characters in an instant figure out how to defeat them. It's like, oh, I guess I just strike at these glowing bubbles. Oh, it hurts them. Hooray! Everybody strike at the glowing bubbles. And that's what they do. But there's no long description of, like, where did these creatures come from? There's no fear. There's just that suspense, that action of, mm-hmm. oh, man, we're going to die from these things if we don't hurry up. And now there's a lightning storm that's going to strike us. So now the odds are doubly against us.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I feel like, well,
sounds like a pacing thing too there.
Pacing. Yeah. So those were the two things I heard, the cut twos, like you said, the pacing or just the
abstract. Sounds like deliberate. Abstract. Sounds like deliberate. Maybe deliberate, like action cut or cuts, like deliberate cuts in some way,
mm-hmm.
in describing the strange rather than what's I don't know. I'm filtering that. Does that sound like what you were saying?
Yeah, I mean two totally different things.
Yeah,
but that's what I heard while you guys were talking.
Well, okay, so sticking with our kind of we had a lot of success with our. A one-page exercise with this last one. And now we're kind of talking about that's a big pause I'm going to have to cut out.
Boing, boing, boing. Boing, boing. I love that sound, by the way.
Which, I'm going to pause the recording here for a second.
Okay.
Well.
All right. So the exercise here.
Right.
All right. So you want me to read it?
Yes, please. So we get our rules out to everybody and then we'll write them down and.
This is from Janet Burroway's Writing Fiction. I'm reading out of the fifth edition. The subtitle is A Guide to Narrative Craft. And I will say that I have not read this whole book, but the several chapters that I have read have been extremely useful.
Okay.
My wife went to the reason why we have two versions of this book is my wife went to a fine arts high school in. At that time, which is it was a pretty brutal curriculum and workshop space. This was one of the main texts that they read. All right, so we're looking at the writing assignments in the chapter Long Ago and Far Away on Place and Time.
Okay.
Page 195, exercise 3. Write a scene in a setting that is likely to be quite familiar to your readers. supermarket, dormitory, classroom, movie theater, suburban house, etc. But that is unfamiliar, strange, outlandish, or outrageous to the central character. Let us feel the strangeness through the character's eyes.
Cool.
I guess that's kind of almost a little bit of a show don't tell there at the end.
Yep. And it's hard enough but broad enough, like our like this one that we had with the table exercise.
Right.
That I think we can get some good stuff out of it.
To start with, but it gives a possibility of a variety of images to start from.
Cool. I think that'll work. Is Eric still in the room with you?
He's here. Still here. Right. Still present.
Are you gonna write with us on this one, Eric, and see if we can join you in on the next laboratory and
I'd love to give it a shot.
All right. Cool. Excellent. Because we're at 2 hours and 7 minutes for this. Because we can't stop talking. Well, I'm gonna
two format of the
two-parter. All right. So everybody, whoever is listening, you have your exercise. We'll see everybody in a month, and good luck. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
All right, there you have it, laboratory number 4. Thanks for listening. Come back in a month. We'll have another one ready for you. Have a good summer, and I hope you had a good 4th of July, and enjoy August and the sweaty, sweaty hot times. Okay, I'll see y'all later. Bye.